We've just heard about how the vagaries of intellectual property can influence the fate of books, old and new. But obviously, humans are also instruments of literary destiny. As a newly minted editorial assistant at Norton, writer Tom Bissell was able to resuscitate an out-of-print novel called Desperate Characters by Paula Fox. Bissell convinced Norton to republish Fox's book, reviving her career. In his new book, Magic Hours, Bissell writes that the experience shook his faith in books. Tom, welcome back to the show.
It's always great to be here with you.
The faith that I'm talking about was your belief in the power of great art to rise above, quote, base commerce and sheer indifference and live.
What shook my faith was the idea that suddenly I was somehow the most important part of this process. And I think processes seem much more reassuring when you're not part of them.
And your experience showed how random events can rule the destinies of the greatest works of art. You cite the novels of Kafka.
Kafka asked for all of his work to be burned. One of the two people he told to burn his work did it. The other did not. Now, if Max Brod, the guy who did not burn Kafka's work, had, as I put it, loved him enough to take his plea to him seriously, you know, we would have lost one of the most emblematic writers of the 20th century. In the case of Paula Fox, this was a writer who was completely out of print. I was an editorial assistant at a house that was not known for encouraging its editorial assistants to propose reprints of out-of-print novels. And yet on the day that I brought the book up, I remember everyone was in a kind of a good mood. Everyone just seemed sort of happy that meeting.
It could have been the barometer or a particularly tasty lunch or your personality.
It could have been any one of those things. And the fact that the book took off, launching Paula back into literary consciousness, she's really recognized as one of the most significant post-war writers. All these chance events that led up to my even knowing of that book and then that gave me the strange confidence to propose this to my colleagues, it freaked me out a little bit. It made me realize how fragile these processes are.
And is that why in your essay you traced the tenuous fates of three writers that we might never have heard of or certainly not remembered, Walt Whitman, Herman Melville, and Emily Dickinson?
Now, of the three, Walt Whitman's survival was the least surprising because he was always a pretty famous writer, but I think amongst the literary tastemakers of his day, he was regarded as a bit of a joke. And he certainly wrote a lot of poems that encouraged them in that thinking. And he was such a shameless self-promoter that I think people kind of got really sick of him. So in Whitman's case, I think it wasn't all the people who knew him personally were dead. You know, that allowed people who didn't remember what a self-promoting ass he could be from time to time that they were able to go back to his work and rediscover it.
And what about Herman Melville?
Melville is the one that I think should keep novelists up at night. Who, you know, he had two very early successes, which were published as nonfiction, but in fact were very heavily fictionalized accounts of his life in Fiji. They were very successful, and he sort of set himself to change the game. And he wrote this massive, incredibly weird, ambitious novel, unlike any novel anyone had ever written before, Moby Dick. And it was a resounding unsuccess. It sold 3,000 copies over its 36 years in print.
And so how did he come roaring back and become enshrined in the canon?
The one Melville resuscitation attempt that stuck was Carl Van Doren, a very influential American critic. And he, according to the legend, found a copy of Moby Dick in a used bookstore, went home, read it, was so blown away that this book had like completely vanished from literary consciousness, and he wrote an essay about it. D.H. Lawrence noticed that essay, Ian Forster noticed that essay, and then in the teens and the 20s, Moby Dick actually re-entered American consciousness, and all of his books were brought back into print, in which they have stubbornly stuck since then.
So you suspect that if it hadn't been for this used bookstore and random chance, that just wouldn't have happened.
It's a very good argument for used bookstores, isn't it?
Emily Dickinson, she relied basically, posthumously, on her sister.
Her sister was the one person that seemed to understand what she was up to. And the woman who wound up editing Emily Dickinson's poems never met her face to face. And Emily Dickinson would write poems up in the attic while this woman would play the piano downstairs. And they would leave gifts for each other at the top and bottom of the stairs, but they never actually met. And when Emily Dickinson died, this woman, Mabel Todd, just out of sheer devotion, and Lavinia Dickinson, Emily Dickinson's sister, pressured every New England literary figure they could think of to put these poems out there. And just like Melville, she was doing something so utterly new that people just were unable aesthetically to recognize that this was great. Houghton Mifflin had the poem sent to them, the great Boston publisher, and they were returned as too queer to publish. When the poems finally were published, the public instantly recognized that this was something spectacular.
And perhaps one of the greatest lessons of your essay is that these chaotic forces that determine the fate of an artistic work have always been with us. And you cite Aristophanes, who lost a contest but won immortality.
Yes. Aristophanes, The Clouds, placed third to two other plays in this dramatic contest. However, the two plays that we know were judged to be, quote, better than Aristophanes' play, they were like dust in the wind. We have no idea what happened to them. They don't exist anymore. And it's just sheer chance that any of Aristophanes' plays survived. I mean, most of them didn't. The ones we have no idea if they're his stinkers.
The good stuff doesn't always rise to the top.
No, and I'd like to imagine an alien civilization who has only, say, The Firm, Sidney Sheldon's collected works, and the Book of Mormon to determine what we were like today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Tom Bissell's new book is called Magic Hours.
At home, sitting in my favorite nook, a girl's trying to get me eat some dinner she cooked. I'm reading a book, girl, I'm reading a book. Don't you ever interrupt me while I'm reading a book.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Louisa Beck and Rob Schoon, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
If you ever interrupt me, you can bet you're gonna see the nasty me, the nasty me.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.